Thank you for downloading Business Matters live on the BBC World Service 5 days a week at 9 a.m. Singapore time and 8 p.m. New York time.
It's 0100 GMT. Hello, I'm Dominic Laurie. This is Business Matters on the BBC World Service. Should a cable or internet company be able to charge a corporation more to get their content to customers than they do a teenager posting cat videos? And should the internet be regulated in the same way as, say, water or electricity? Two questions that have been answered in the US, at least for a while. And the Indian government announces a $137 billion investment in its railway network over the next 5 years. Many say it's much needed.
The rail transport system today contributes to just about 33% of all the transport that happens in the country, meaning that other forms of transport are more economical, and this, I think, is largely a function of inefficiencies.
First, the BBC News.
BBC News with Jonathan Izard. Relatives of Western hostages who were beheaded by Islamic State say they want the militant known as Jihadi John to be captured alive to face justice. He's now been identified as Mohammed Emwazi. He was born in Kuwait and brought up in Britain. He appeared clad in black in footage showing the decapitation of the British aid worker David Haynes and others. Mr. Haynes' widow, Dragana, spoke to the BBC.
I don't know what to say anymore. I mean, I can only hope that he'll be caught. I was because, as I said, ever since I found out that David has been murdered, I have been hoping that this man will be identified and eventually caught. But it's difficult to be reminded of it all again.
The head of the United Nations Cultural Agency has called for an emergency meeting of the Security Council in response to a video showing Islamic State militants destroying ancient artefacts at a museum in the Iraqi city of Mosul. Irina Bokova called it a cultural tragedy. Vincent Dowd reports.
The propaganda video was posted online with music already overlaid, but you can hear underneath the violent hammering and the drilling as Islamic State militants destroy statues and other ancient artefacts at Mosul Museum. A man tells the camera, "Our prophet ordered us to remove all these statues, as his followers did when they conquered nations." Outside, the video shows the destruction of large statues of winged bulls, which date back almost 3,000 years and which stood at the gates of Nineveh.
US intelligence agencies have warned that cyber attacks pose a greater security risk than terrorism. Russia, China, Iran and North Korea were listed as a source of threats. Naomi Grimley in Washington has the details.
The Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, said that Russia and China in particular were developing very sophisticated cyber programs. In Russia's case, that threat might be more severe than previously realised. So it now tops the list of countries that pose a cyber risk to American interests. In a document to accompany his testimony, James Clapper claimed the Russian military was establishing its own cyber command to conduct offensive activities, including inserting malware or malicious software into enemy systems.
A federal judge in Argentina has dismissed claims that President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her foreign minister, Héctor Timmermans, covered up an alleged Iranian involvement in the deadly bombing of a Jewish centre 2 decades ago. The judge said there was not a single piece of evidence that pointed to the head of state. The accusations had been made by a special prosecutor, Alberto Nisman, who was found dead in his flat last month with a bullet wound to the head. It's not clear whether he was murdered or killed himself. World News from the BBC. US regulators have imposed tough new rules on internet service providers in an attempt to ensure equal treatment for all customers. The Federal Communication Commission voted to ban a two-tier service where a company could pay a fee to ensure its products were delivered faster. Critics say the ban would drive up consumer costs. The parents of 43 Mexican students who went missing 5 months ago have been leading a march through the streets of Mexico City to demand a full investigation. Katie Watson was there.
The months pass, but the families are not giving up hope. They're carrying posters with pictures of their loved ones. Their protest here is a peaceful one. The government has tried to bring an end to the questions. Just a few weeks ago, the Attorney General delivered a blow by saying its investigation found that the students had been handed over to a drugs gang and subsequently killed. But other independent investigators have disputed those findings, and the families here say without evidence they want their sons returned alive. They're marching to the presidential palace to make their demands heard.
The former Secretary-General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, has arrived in Cuba to lend encouragement to peace negotiators from the Colombian government and the largest rebel group, the FARC, who have been engaged in talks for more than 2 years. The peace talks, being held in Havana, are aimed at ending 5 decades of conflict. Police say a pearl-studded dress worn to the Oscars by the Kenyan actress Lupita Nyong'o has been stolen from her hotel room in Los Angeles. Alistair Leithhead is in the city.
Long, figure-hugging, ivory in colour and covered in 6,000 pearls. The Calvin Klein collection dress, made by the designer Francisco Costa, is estimated to be worth more than $150,000. Lupita Nyong'o won an Academy Award last year for her performance in 12 Years a Slave and was presenting at this year's Oscars. One of her representatives reported the theft, telling sheriffs it had been taken from her hotel room in West Hollywood 3 days after the ceremony.
BBC News.
Hello and welcome to Business Matters. I'm Dominic Laurie. On the programme today, President Obama welcomes a move to regulate internet traffic more tightly in the US, striking down the hopes of the cable and internet industry.
It's overreaching. It's unnecessary. We don't have a problem in the United States with our internet. Because of this, we will see a reduction in investment in the infrastructure. That's going to affect consumers.
We'll be live in Sao Paulo, Brazil, to hear how a once mighty company, the pride of the nation, has fallen from the stars into the gutter.
To get rid of evil, we must stick a knife into our own flesh. The government, the politicians, the business people, all those who have occupied public positions.
And I'll be joined throughout the programme by two guests on opposite sides of the Pacific. Alison van Diggelen, host of the radio programme Fresh Dialogues. I think it's got a bit of a green hue, that programme. She's in San Francisco. Tony Nash is from Delta Economics, based in Singapore. They'll be commenting on everything they hear on the programme. All coming up in the next hour on Business Matters. Now, if you're 30 or over, your first experience of the internet probably sounded a bit like this. Still sends shivers down my spine, that. Would it work? Would it not work? Who knew? Well, internet speeds and what we're able to watch, listen and do on the internet have come a long way since those days, and that's created a problem. We expect to be able to do more and more with our connection. To prevent us, say, having to go to a library, a video store, a supermarket or a CD shop, we now want to be able to do those purchases online, either so things are sent to our house or so that we can watch or stream programmes like this on demand to our living room.
You want to know what takes real courage? Holding it all together when the stakes are this high.
I have lived under the threat of death for a year now. I alone should suffer the consequences of those choices. No one else. And those consequences, they're coming.
I am prepared to behave like a model inmate, and I feel I no longer pose a threat.
Like what you've done with the place?
Sadly, it's starting to feel like home in here.
3, 2, 1, go!
Now, if you're wondering what the links were between all those programmes, they were offerings on Netflix, the content provider Netflix, House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Orange is the New Black. Well, the change that's made it possible for us to watch these shows online has taken a large amount of investment from internet providers and cable companies, nowhere more so than in the US. To carry on making that investment and to stop the infrastructure clogging up, those providers wanted to be able to charge media companies like Netflix a premium service so their traffic would be prioritised ahead of, say, a woman uploading her photo albums from holiday or a boy sending a video of him playing football to his friends. Now, a few months ago, they looked like they were going to get their way. Instead, though, there's been a surprise reversal. They got a decision from the American communications regulator, the FCC, that went against them.
All those in favour say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. The item is carried.
Well, that's the so-called principle of net neutrality, the idea that everything passing through the internet should have the same priority. That's been upheld today, and the industry will also be regulated more tightly, much in the same way as utilities like water and electricity. It's a decision that advocates for cable companies are unhappy at. Here's Scott Belcher, CEO of the Telecoms Industry Association, the Telecommunications Industry Association. I asked him what was so worrying.
Because what it does is it takes regulations that were put in place in 1934 to deal with monopoly utilities and applies them to the internet. It's overreaching. It's unnecessary. We don't have a problem in the United States with our internet. And what I worry about is I worry about the Trojan horse effect. This FCC may not overreach. It may use a light touch and it may forbear from the application of a whole bunch of onerous regulations. There's no guarantee that the next administration will act in the same way.
But here's what the supporters of the regulations say, is actually there isn't much competition in the online space, in the internet space, in the infrastructure space. And actually, it is, to a certain extent, sometimes verging on a monopoly. There hasn't been a huge amount of new players, new entrants coming in. And it's so important, it's so vital for everyone's everyday life that it needs to be ensured that everybody can have it.
But applying Title II has nothing to do with the dominance of the different carriers. That's pure economics. We spend $78 billion a year in the United States on building out the infrastructure. I mean, that's a lot of money. The internet isn't just the connections between our computers. It is this huge infrastructure. And because of the free market system that we've got in the United States, the carriers are willing to invest it because they expect a return on their investment.
Do you think it was a mistake then to get everybody thinking and talking and campaigning about this net neutrality issue? Perhaps you just got people thinking about that rather than regulation, and people felt threatened that the little guy was going to get done by the corporation.
But the little guy hasn't gotten done by the corporation. I mean, I think that's one of the big problems with this whole debate is we're all punching at shadows. The advocates are punching at this horrible system that doesn't exist where companies slow down companies they don't like or don't allow them to use the internet or block products or services. But none of those things are happening.
But there have been experiments, haven't there, with some internet providers, Verizon, with some media companies threatening to charge them more.
Yeah, and when it's happened, the companies that have been impacted have used the existing business and regulatory system to stop it.
Was that a mistake? Because it obviously put the fears up people that they wouldn't be able to watch their favorite shows without paying more.
We would agree that carriers shouldn't prioritize and shouldn't slow certain content down or anything like that. We would agree with that. I think, though, the reverse should be true, and that's that if you want to pay for a better service, you should be able to do that.
The trouble with that is that, by definition, the companies are the richest. They have the deepest pockets. So it's the corporations that have the spending power and that will end up making the decisions and bullying other small people around.
Again, as long as you are providing the basic services to everybody, I think that companies should be able to pay more for a better service.
The internet was founded, you'll know, as a not-for-profit enterprise by an academic. The spirit of the internet is a free-for-all, isn't it?
It is, but somebody's got to pay for it, right?
Paint a picture for me of your greatest fear of what might happen under a new regime.
Because of this, what's likely to happen in the United States is that it will be followed by a lawsuit. That lawsuit will take years to work its way through the courts, and during that time, we will have continued uncertainty, and we will see a reduction in investment in the infrastructure. That's going to affect consumers.
That was Scott Belcher, CEO of the Telecoms Industry Association. But those who've been campaigning to preserve net neutrality say the cable company's claim about it hindering investment is a non-starter. Professor Tim Wu from Columbia Law School in New York first coined the term net neutrality more than a decade ago.
It's a very profitable business as it stands with net neutrality rules. The margins in that business, even with net neutrality rules, are north of 95%. They sell a $3 or $4 service for $60 or $80. So they've been making plenty of money, tons of money on broadband. Net neutrality rule says there's this one tiny way of making money that you're not allowed to because it messes with competition. it's a tiny thing in the grand scheme of things.
Verizon has come out with a very neat response this evening. They've written a press release entirely in Morse code, trying to make the claim, I guess, visually, that these new regulations that are going to be imposed on these cable companies were written in the era of the steam locomotive and the telegraph, i.e. treating them like a utility. It isn't a utility, is it? Because it's something that needs constant investment and something that needs to keep up with the times.
I think it's an essential in a modern economy. So it has certain aspects like utility. I agree it needs continued investment. In fact, actually, so did the old utilities. But I think that the compromise that is net neutrality allows, once again, the cable and phone companies to make an awful lot of money. They are making money hand over fist. It's been great for them. You know, they don't like any form of regulation, but the idea that this really gets in the way of their business model is not true. If you've noticed, their stocks haven't gone down at all. And if they, you know, really were threatened, you would imagine investors would flee. But everyone knows the truth. It's just a bluff.
So you feel that even if some of these companies like Verizon decide to invest less, that if they do follow up with their threat, you feel that the market is structured in a way that other companies would come in and take their place and spend money?
No, I don't feel that way at all. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of competition. What I feel, if they don't invest, they'll be shooting themselves in the foot because there's a lot of money to be made here. There's a big return on investment, and they've been profiting handsomely, and I think will continue to profit handsomely. There's no limits on prices in these rules. All it says is they can't block and they can't degrade websites on the Internet. And finally, all this has to be balanced against the more important investment, to my mind, in the Internet sector, that is, in applications. The American Internet sector, and European, but particularly American, has been an incredible engine of growth based on massive investment, more investment than on the telecom and phone side. So there's a huge trade-off here, and I think when you're talking about investment, you can't just look at one side of the equation.
Net neutrality, I can understand why you're passionate about it, but why the other aspect of this change? Why is more regulation necessary? Why was the status quo in terms of more regulation necessary to be changed?
This regulation, to my mind, preserves the status quo. A year ago, the previous net neutrality law was struck down after Verizon, the phone company, sued to destroy it. And so the question was replacing the law that had been destroyed. In my view, this is a restoration of a status quo which has been incredibly successful for economic growth and also freedom of speech.
But haven't some cable companies been experimenting in the last couple of years with Verizon charging Netflix, et cetera, et cetera? There had been the sort of the burgeoning start of a sort of commercial landscape within the cable arena. This now stops that, doesn't it?
Well, it makes it questionable. And I was questionable about those deals in the first place. Yes, there were starting to be deals between companies like YouTube and Comcast to give YouTube preferential services. And I think that's dangerous to competition on the Internet. So net neutrality basically favors small startup entrant companies, and it's worked pretty well. And I guess there's a, if it's not broken, don't fix it attitude in my mind.
That's Professor Tim Wu from Columbia Law School. You heard both sides really there of the debate about whether there should be a sort of net neutrality, a free-for-all, if you want, on the Internet with Internet traffic, or whether there should be allowed to be some priority. Well, the regulators in the US have come down on the side of the free-for-all. We're going to get reaction from our guests after the headlines this hour with Jonathan Izard.
Relatives of hostages beheaded by Islamic State say they want the militant known as Jihadi John to face justice after his true identity was revealed. The head of the UN's cultural agency has called for an emergency meeting of the Security Council after IS followers in Iraq were filmed destroying statues with sledgehammers. US intelligence agencies have warned that large-scale cyber attacks are a greater security threat than terrorism, with Russia posing a particular danger. And a judge in Argentina has dismissed accusations that President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner covered up alleged Iranian involvement in a bomb attack two decades ago.
Thank you, Jonathan. Alison van Diggelen is the host of the radio programme Fresh Dialogues in San Francisco. Alison, great to talk to you.
Great to join you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Tony Nash from Delta Economics, all the way over on the other side of the world, the other side of the Pacific in Singapore. Thanks for coming on, Tony.
Thank you.
Yeah, Alison, let's go to you first. You're in America. This story is an American story, although I think it probably impinges on the rest of the world eventually. Where do you stand on this net neutrality issue? Should companies be able to sort of have a premium service, or is what the regulators have done today the right thing?
I think it's a victory for the champions of the free internet. This is a real gift to the current generation of internet entrepreneurs, the lifeblood of, you know, the next Zuckerberg, shall we say, because it evens the playing field. If they were allowed to get away with, you know, the high rates and the fast track and the slow track that they want, you know, companies like Comcast, AT&T, it would make it really hard for that young startup to compete.
Yeah, the trouble is, though, is if I look at what I do on the internet now compared to 3 or 4 years ago, it is beyond compare. I am trying, you know, I want to watch films, I want to see my whole photo albums, I want to live my whole life there. But there has to come a point, therefore, where some traffic is prioritised over others because the infrastructure just won't cope.
That's an arguable thing. I actually read from Mark Cuban's comment. He's an entrepreneur and some say a spokesman for AT&T. And he's making the case. He's saying, do you want the information coming to your driverless car in the future to be buffering? So he's arguing for, you know, this extra fast lane, and it may come in the future. But and I agree with your point. Data transfer is expected to increase eightfold in the next 10 years. We're just getting addicted to our videos and online streaming. But I think what the FCC did today was a good thing.
Tony Nash in Singapore. Tony, some of the countries in the world that have been best at investing in fast internet infrastructure have been in the Far East. I think of South Korea, for example. I imagine in Singapore there's a pretty good network as well. Has the infrastructure kept up with what people want to do with the internet?
Sure, absolutely it has. You know, I used to work for an enterprise telecom provider, and I think a lot of the ideological discussion aside, the telecom providers have every opportunity to make money on the data, the capacity that goes into data centers and colocation facilities through the local loops and through the undersea cable access and everything else. So this idea of prioritizing traffic and charging for prioritizing traffic is a bit of nonsense because they have every opportunity to charge for access to the telecom network at the point of the data center. So the problem is,
who are they charging, Tony? Just you know a lot about
this. They would be charging the companies themselves. So who does,
well,
for example,
like Netflix?
The Netflix or Amazon or whatever data center. If those guys want access to the internet, they have to go through a telecom system in order to get access to the internet. The problem that the telecom companies are facing is that that's an incredibly competitive business. Okay. So they're trying to find a way to recoup fees because that, you know, local loop access and undersea cable access, there's actually a glut of capacity there. Even though we've had growth, there's a glut of capacity there.
Interesting.
Okay?
Yeah.
And so, and as a consumer, you know, you pay for your, you know, your broadband access at home. So, you know, these telecom companies are making money on both ends and in the middle.
Interesting.
And so this whole discussion, in my view, is a bit of nonsense. And it really is, you know, they're making money off of my home cable or telephone broadband access. They're making money at the colocation facility at the data center. They're making money on the undersea cable. And in many cases, those are all separate companies.
Okay.
But when you mention, say, Singapore, South Korea, Japan, other places, yes, the investment has happened through private companies and in many cases with government subsidies. But yes, it's, you know, the broadband here is very, very good.
Okay.
And it actually is in the US as well.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you, Tony. We'll come back to you for more comment on this story elsewhere in the programme. Let's go, though, to the BBC South America business correspondent, Daniel Galas, who's live for us in Sao Paulo. Daniel, you're looking at the fall from grace of one of Brazil's largest and most admired companies.
Yes, we're talking about Petrobras, which is Brazil's giant state oil company, one of the biggest oil producers in the world, and a very promising and exciting company just a few years ago. But since a really strong corruption scandal rocked it a few weeks ago, it seems like years, but a few weeks ago, the company has lost a lot of money, a lot of its market value, and now it's in a very difficult position, putting pretty much all of the Brazilian political and economic scene in sort of fierce battles within itself. I spoke to quite a few people about Petrobras over the past few days, and this is what they told me.
The music you're hearing is the soundtrack to 2002's City of God, one of Brazil's biggest international box office hits. If you pay attention to the movie's opening credits, you'll see a familiar logo present in many Brazilian movies, Petrobras. When it comes to sponsorships in Brazil, the giant state oil company seems to be everywhere, from films to sports. It financed over 500 films. Many of the Brazilian athletes who will compete in next year's Olympics in Rio are training with Petrobras funding. To Brazilians, the company is much more than just oil. But if you ask people in the streets what Petrobras means to them today, the image that comes up is very different.
Corruption, just that.
Fraud, theft.
Dirt, money embezzlement, a terrible image.
The mood has definitely soured since a large-scale police operation unveiled corruption at the heart of Petrobras last year. Former company directors are being investigated for having allegedly accepted bribes in exchange for exclusive billion-dollar contracts. The scandal has taken its toll on employees. This is Luiz Henrique, and he works at Petrobras headquarters in Rio de Janeiro. Earlier this month, he was part of a group of workers that launched an unofficial social media campaign. They took pictures of themselves and posted them online under the hashtag SouPetrobras, I am Petrobras. He says honest, hardworking people like himself are the ones who really represent the company, not those executives in the news. Luiz Henrique tells me that working for Petrobras is like becoming a doctor. Everyone in his family was immensely proud when he was hired. But now he's being bullied for his job. Recently, when Luiz Henrique mentioned he worked for Petrobras at an evening class he's attending, the teacher remarked, "Should we pay you 3% of our salaries?" A reference to how much bribery was allegedly paid to Petrobras executives. Luiz was not amused.
Right now, Brazil needs not only to punish those who are guilty, but also to lift Petrobras out of this cycle of bad news. We need to get Petrobras out of intensive care.
This is the view of Hugo Mota, a 25-year-old congressman who has just landed one of the thorniest and most coveted jobs in Brazilian politics. He's heading a Congress inquiry into Petrobras, which is being launched today in Brasilia.
To get rid of evil, we must stick a knife into our own flesh. The government, the politicians, the business people, all those who have occupied public positions must be accountable for what they did. What we can't have is this eternal feeling that corruption still exists inside Petrobras.
Not everyone believes Congress will really stick a knife into anyone's flesh. Some of the congressmen responsible for this investigation belong to parties that have received money from Petrobras contractors now accused of corruption. The election donations were all legal, but will politicians have independence to investigate their own donors? It's a question that comes up frequently in many investigations into corruption in Brazil, and I put it to Mr. Mota.
This is how election campaigns are funded in Brazil. Private companies donate money to parties. This is how our law works. Our job with this inquiry is to prove that we can be unbiased. Everyone who's watching us, the press and all economic agents, are the ones who'll be able to say whether this inquiry is working seriously or whether it is just a sham.
Before the crisis, Petrobras was on a high with its massive offshore oil discoveries. But since police operations began, its market value has tumbled. This week, Petrobras debt was again downgraded by a credit rating agency, now to junk status. Under a new CEO, the company now hopes to set its record straight and put this scandal behind it.
That's Daniel Gallas, the BBC's Daniel Gallas in Sao Paulo, with a very interesting report about how Petrobras has fallen from grace over the last few weeks and months. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Business Matters with me, Dominic Lawrie. Now, if you've ever taken a train journey in India, you'll know how important and frustrating trains can be there. Every day, thousands of trains start journeys that last sometimes for days, providing a low-cost and highly sociable way for family and business people to reach all corners of the country. The ritual of tea, chai in disposable terracotta cups starts many a conversation. But many of those 23 million people who travel on India's state-owned railways every day have to deal with trains, tracks, stations and equipment that are ageing badly. Delays and even worse, accidents are very common. 2 weeks ago, for example, 11 people died after three coaches of a train derailed in the southern Indian state of Karnataka. Hundreds of people have been killed in recent years. Now the government has announced plans to invest $137 billion over the next 5 years to bring Indian rail travel up to speed. The BBC's Ashley Neem reports from Mumbai.
It's the evening rush hour and I'm walking up the stairs of a suburban train station in Mumbai. Hundreds of people are pouring in every minute and it's busy, crowded and chaotic. On the platform, in the half hour that I've been here, I've seen some passengers wait for three or four trains to pass through the station before they can get on. And even then, once inside the carriage, they tell me it can be so packed that you feel like you can barely breathe or move.
We need more train and maybe modernization of old train. And let's have the longer train, the bigger one.
We are travelling daily from one station to another, so we wish that government should give us more number of railway trains so that the crowded trains get less crowded and people can easily travel from trains.
India has 64,000 kilometres of track, but only a fifth of that has been built since it gained independence from Britain in 1947. Since then, the number of people using the network has increased sevenfold, and now more than 8.5 billion trips are made each year. Most of the money the railways generate from carrying passengers and especially freight is spent keeping the system running. Until recently, India only allowed limited foreign investment in its railways, which are state-owned. But last year, the government changed the rules so that overseas firms could take 100% ownership of part of its rail network. With less than a third of goods transported by rail, some firms say India needs better infrastructure, but it needs it to be built more quickly. Banmali Agrawala is the chief executive of GE South Asia. He explains what he believes is holding things up.
As far as the locomotives are concerned, the government has been in discussion for more than a decade. It's a question of willingness of the government to let the private sector come in and partner the government in introducing the latest technology in rail freight particularly. The rail transport system today contributes to just about 33% of all the transport that happens in the country, meaning that other forms of transport are more economical, and this I think is largely a function of inefficiencies.
The Canadian firm Bombardier is among four multinational companies bidding for some of the business to upgrade the rail network. Workers at its Gujarat factory have been making train carriages for India since 2009. But despite the desperate need at home, the compartments they're making will be exported because orders just aren't coming in. The firm says it's been waiting on a decision on a locomotives project for 6 years. So while Bombardier welcomes the plan to bring in more foreign investment, its India boss, Hirsch Dinger, wants more detail.
We have to see what kind of financing model which the railway minister would like to bring in. Then we have to see how we can do it. Today it's too early to say. If not this year, they decide, okay, they will not go ahead with the big ticket projects and they will like to concentrate only on the small items, then obviously we have the other options available of exporting the product outside India.
Another foreign investor has told me they've been waiting more than two decades on a project, but travellers need the government to clear up that uncertainty. Only with outside expertise, technology and cash can India's dated and overcrowded railway be upgraded fast enough for passengers to see an improvement in their daily commute.
That's Ashley Neem in Mumbai with some of the noises and the sounds from the Indian railways. Many people familiar with them who have travelled around India by train. I've done that. Tony, I know you have as well. You're based in Singapore, but you used to travel to India an awful lot. Is that right?
Yes, yes. And look, I think it's a good move. I think there's a lot of pride in the rail system in India. Historically, there has been. And I think infrastructure investments in India is badly needed, and both to get people around and to get goods to market. So I think it's a great move.
Yeah, because the trouble with India is that the train system isn't great, and also the road system isn't great either, is it? So there isn't really much for the business community, for example. You're left with a few bad choices.
Right. And if Modi's kind of make in India policy is going to get some legs underneath it, they're going to have the hard infrastructure to be able to get those things that are made there to other markets and to other domestic markets as well.
Alison van Diggelen in San Francisco. Alison, I remember traveling on the train in India, and some of the most sociable times I've ever had in my life were those sort of 25-hour rail journeys where you're just chatting to all these people over cups of tea and stuff. You've done the same, haven't you? You've traveled by train in India too.
I have, yes. I've done that trip from Delhi to Agra to visit, of course, the Taj Mahal. And I have to say it was in August during the monsoon season, and I would have paid double for some AC. but regardless of that, I agree with Tony. It's a very good move for India. I think the infrastructure is the backbone of the country and the economy, and they're investing for the long term.
Interesting that the US has never really believed in rail travel, hasn't it? I mean, you had those projects that were supposed to get off the ground in the big bailout after the financial crisis. They didn't really happen, did they? Why? Why aren't the Americans so convinced about high-speed rail, for example?
I think they love their motor cars or their electric cars now. But
is it a they, Alison? Because I can hear a Scottish accent lingering way from a few decades back.
Yes, indeed. I'm from Scotland. I'm from Glasgow in Scotland.
But so.
Jerry Brown is a huge advocate for train travel, and they are moving ahead. They've actually broken ground on the high-speed train.
Is he the governor of California? Is that right?
That's right, yeah. Between San Francisco and LA. That is moving ahead.
So finally, that is going to happen, finally, because that's been talked about for years, isn't it?
It has indeed, and it still faces a lot of opposition, but they have broken ground, and they're doing it in sections.
Why have they started to perhaps believe in that?
Jerry Brown has really pushed it. He's put his strong political backing behind it, and he described it to me. I said one time when I interviewed him, "How can we afford it?" And he said, "How could the French build the Cathedral of Chartres?" You know, it's like we have to invest for the long term. He's a very eloquent, powerful speaker, and he's managed to get enough of support for this.
Something else you've been doing, Alison, is you've been at a conference which can be quite dull, but I don't think the one you were at was dull. It was called the Lead on Watermark Conference in Silicon Valley, part of the drive to achieve more diversity in the tech industries. Now, the thing is, if I think of some of the big tech companies that have really made global success, there is quite a lot of diversity in those companies. So what's the problem?
Well, the problem is the stats are not echoing what you just said. 11% of executives in Silicon Valley are women. 20% of software developers overall are women. These, you know, it's very much you're in the minority if you're a woman in tech.
Are you talking about gender diversity specifically, rather than ethnic diversity?
Yes, ethnic diversity is even worse. I think the stats for Google was 1% of their employee workforce is black, 17% is female, 83% male. So it's pretty dire. So this conference was the energy was high. It was electrifying, actually. 5,000 female executives gathered in Silicon Valley. It was from the worlds of tech, media, and fashion. And we had keynotes including Hillary Clinton, Diane von Furstenberg, Jill Abramson, and Brené Brown, as well as tech luminaries like Intel's Renee Brown. Very exciting place to be on Tuesday. A lot of women there. And I have a clip from Hillary's speech, where she outlined the challenges that women face in the tech industry and why this is important for the wider economy to get more women in tech.
Inclusivity is more than a buzzword or a box to check. It is a recipe for success in the 21st century. Bringing different perspectives and life experiences into corporate offices, engineering labs, and venture funds is likely to bring fresh ideas and higher revenues. And in our increasingly multicultural country, in an increasingly interdependent world, building a more diverse talent pool can't just be a nice-to-do for business. It has to be a must-do. It is still shocking. The numbers are sobering. Just 11% of executives in Silicon Valley and only about 20% of software developers overall are women. One recent report on the gender pay gap in the Valley found that a woman with a bachelor's degree here tends to make 60% less than a man with the same degree. We're going backwards in a field that is supposed to be all about moving forward.
She's quite a talker, isn't she? Very eloquent woman, Hillary Clinton. Alison, I guess the problem is that you listed some very, very eminent women who were talking and I guess inspiring people in the conference, but do people feel that those women are so high achievers, such high achievers, that maybe they're out of reach? Did you actually manage to speak to more normal people, if you want to, who've made it in tech, some more sort of middle manager women, or I don't know?
Yes, I did. I spoke to a number of women in tech. I actually spoke with the CEO of Watermark, Marlene Williamson, and she emphasized the need for women to do it for themselves and for other women. And that's how we get economies of scale. That's how you build your power base. I also spoke with Kimberly Bryant, who has made a startup. She feels so strongly about this that she wants to help create a pipeline of young tech entrepreneurs, and in particular, young Black girls. Her nonprofit is called Black Girls Code, and her whole mission is to get more Black girls from 7 to 17 exposed to computer science, get them into classes, get them into summer camps, and feed the pipeline for young entrepreneurs going into tech who are female and ready to change the world, like Zuckerberg.
We think that's a huge need for really creating this pipeline of young tech entrepreneurs that are women. But one of my personal goals is I really want to see a girl or a woman leading a major tech company like Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Apple. I think that having a woman at the head of a tech company and the founder of a tech company of that level will do so much to really change the whole image of the tech industry being male dominated. This movement for diversity and inclusion in technology is not just a good thing to do. I think it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I just looked at Kimberly's website, Black Girls Code. Quite a cool website, actually. So lots of interesting information. Yeah,
She's doing a lot of good work. She's actually bringing it to London, you'll be interested to know. They're hoping to seed a chapter in London this summer.
Well, maybe we could have a chat to her. Tony Nash, looking at Delta Economics' website. You've got 3 out of 8 women as the named people on your website, a female CEO. What about wider Singapore? How easy is it for a woman to rise through the glass ceiling in Singapore?
Well, I think first on Delta Economics, we do have a female CEO, and we are a majority female company, and we are a fintech company. We're a big data economics firm we process 11 billion data points a month. So we are a finance tech company. So we do have a female leader. Yeah. And there are female leaders in the Valley with HP, that sort of thing. But, in Singapore, I find that women are very persistent, and there are quite a number of female business leaders and female leaders in government. And so if you look, for example, at the head of Korea is a woman, right? And, we've actually started to have female ministers in Japan, which is amazing. And there are a number of senior Chinese female political women and Chinese women business leaders. The head of ICICI Bank in India is a woman. And so, there's a growing number of women business leaders.
You're implying you're spotting a change.
I am, actually. And I think, to see some of the change in Japan, although it's very slow and very painful, we are actually starting to see a change there as well.
Interesting. Very interesting. Thank you, Tony. Tony Nash from Delta Economics, based in Singapore. Also, Alison van Diggelen, by way of Scotland, Glasgow, all the way to San Francisco. Quite a journey there. Let's have a look first, though, at the headlines with Jonathan Izard.
Relatives of hostages beheaded by Islamic State say they want the militant known as Jihadi John to face justice after his true identity was revealed. The head of the UN's cultural agency has called for an emergency meeting of the Security Council after US followers in Iraq were filmed destroying statues with sledgehammers. And US intelligence agencies have warned that large-scale cyber attacks are a greater security threat than terrorism, with Russia posing a particular danger. Full details on those stories at the top of the hour. But turning to the markets, it was another record close for the Dow Jones on Wall Street on Thursday, up 15 points at 18,224. And in Japan, shares are up too, with the Nikkei Index in Tokyo opening at its highest level for 15 years on Friday at 18,844. So it's onwards and upwards, Dominic.
Lots of investors will be happy to hear that. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Well, every day we head out east and we pinpoint one country to hear about the morning headlines being made there. Today it's the turn of Jennifer Pak in Malaysia. Jennifer, what's making the headlines this morning?
Well, this week, people are talking about the Malaysian Prime Minister's wife's hair. She was at a public forum about the new consumer tax that's coming into effect in April. And she was trying to connect with people in the audience, saying that, it, of course, everybody is going to have to make some adjustments. And she was lamenting the fact that when she gets her hairstylist to come over to her house, they're charging some 1,200 ringgit just to color her hair.
How much is that, Jennifer?
Just some over $400 US. And people are saying, well, some families, actually millions of families in Malaysia, live off of that per month. Families live off of that amount.
Sounds like
per
an extraordinary thing to say. I mean, it really, we have, you know, there's the phrase, you have a tin ear. I mean, a really unsubtle thing to say.
Indeed. Now, the Prime Minister's wife is well known for her big hair, a love of luxury goods, and has always been mocked, widely mocked and criticized for it. This was, I suppose, I think she was trying to connect with housewives. She was trying to say housewives such as myself, you know, and because she's a
But she was using a $400 haircut as an example. Yeah. That's the issue, I guess.
Yeah. And on top of that, tailoring dresses, she said, cost well over $100. And that's more than half of a month's salary for some families. So she was saying that it's very difficult because they have to make beautiful clothes to attend functions. There are many functions for housewives in Malaysia, but the prices are just too high for them to afford. And she says so. That's why she says she needs to call for a cap for some of these people who are unscrupulously trying to get more money out of housewives such as herself. And unfortunately, this comment was seized by the opposition-friendly media, if you will. And a lot of people say this is just another example of just how out of touch the Prime Minister's family is. This is, of course, not the first time he's been criticized before. The Prime Minister himself, had once tried to talk about the cost of living because he was heavily criticized for it. He said, well, why does everybody talk to me when prices go up, but they don't commend me or give me praise when the price of kangkong, a very popular green vegetable, goes down? And indeed, the price did go down by about 50%, but people were mocking him and saying, this is a vegetable that grows on the side of the road. Sometimes you don't even have to buy it.
Jennifer, does Malaysia feel like a better off place now than it did, say, 3 or 4 years ago? Has its economy done quite well in recent years?
I would say it has weathered the global economic crisis rather well. It's been registering a very moderate growth between 4 to 5%, and that's very enviable for many countries, I'm sure.
Indeed.
The problem is that everybody is looking towards the future, what comes next, because Malaysia's economy is heavily dependent on exports, cheap exports. It cannot compete anymore with China. It hasn't got the workforce to do the research and development to move up into a higher level of producing these electronic goods that China is doing as well. So China's cornered both the top end and the low end market. Malaysia's always been in between, and it can't quite figure out where it needs to go at this point. It needs to move away from its natural resources, such as oil and gas, palm oil. That's the world's second largest producer. And so right now they're trying to find its place. How are they going to do that? And in it, there are lots of structural weaknesses. The fact that there is positive discrimination for the ethnic Malay majority, that there are many people who feel they cannot get ahead because of their race and religion in this country. Yeah. It has driven a lot of brains outside. And so Malaysia is grappling with how they're going to attract these people back in order to move Malaysia forward and to be competitive.
Very interesting. Thank you very much. That's this morning's news coming out of Malaysia. Jennifer Pack, it's a story of the Prime Minister's wife's hair. It sounds like an old Nordic fairy tale, doesn't it, really? We're going to hear from our regular contributor, Lucy Kellaway, next. Good management, it's often said, isn't just about getting the best out of your staff. It's about hiring the right people in the first place. But as we all know, that's not always how things work out. What do you do when you get it disastrously wrong as a boss and you realise you've hired a dud who's more interested in going on Facebook than financial spreadsheets? Over to Lucy Kellaway of the Financial Times newspaper.
A couple of weeks ago, a Texan teenager by the name of Sella tapped out a tweet that read, "Ooh, I start this F*A* job tomorrow," followed by half a dozen thumbs down symbols. Whereupon the manager of the pizza parlour that had just hired her saw the tweet and tweeted back, "And no, you don't start that F*A* job today. I just fired you. Good luck with your no money, no job life." Judging by the response online, most people under 25 see Sella as a hero. She was exercising her right to freedom of speech. She didn't mention the name of the restaurant, and so it was outrageous she got fired for it. But most people over 25 took the opposite view. They thought she behaved like a spoilt brat and deserved what she got. Yet both sides agree that to get the sack before you even start a job is pretty remarkable. Twitter appears to have changed how we work forever. But on close inspection, Twitter has changed nothing. All it's done is speed things up a bit, which is a thoroughly good thing all round. Someone not fit for the job was fired before any damage was done. All managers, even experienced ones, often pick hopeless people. What is surprising is how long it usually takes for the axe to fall on the misfits. The other day I met a big-name CEO who is credited for having hired some of the most successful executives in the UK. He told me that he was no better at selection than the next person, but what he was good at was the speed with which he gave the duds the boot. His proudest moment was firing a senior executive after just one day on the job. Within hours of the man joining, a queue had formed outside the CEO's office of people complaining about the newcomer's abrasive style. By tea time, the CEO took action, told the man he'd made a mistake, apologised, paid him some money, and off he went. I'm not saying that all disappointing hires should be fired instantly, just that when the mismatch is fundamental, there is no such thing as too quick. A man I know of was hired to a top job a couple of years ago. He was interviewed by half a dozen senior people, all of whom were impressed by him. Yet he turned out to be a disaster. He was arrogant and loathed by all the people who reported to him. It took a year to get shot of him, but by then the damage to the business had been prodigious. Had anyone consulted the CEO's PA, things might have gone differently. When she took him up in the lift, he didn't meet her eye and barely responded to her pleasantries. She knew it was never going to work. So to ask security guards, receptionists and PAs what they think of candidates may make a lot of sense. If 360-degree appraisals are a good idea, 360-degree interviews are a better one. In the former, fearful underlings shrink from telling the truth. But in a 360-degree interview, they would surely rush forward to prevent the rude, the overbearing and the maladjusted from getting the job in the first place.
Lucy Kellaway of the Financial Times. Alison van Diggelen and Tony Nash are two guests today. That's an interesting hypothesis, isn't it? If you're a good manager, it's not necessarily how you hire the best ones, it's how you get quickly you get rid of the bad ones. What do you think of that, Alison? Alison, are you there? Tony, if we lost Alison for a second.
You know, I fully agree with Lucy. I have had my share of stellar hires and I have had my share of really embarrassing hires. I think the problem is the reality behind what Lucy's saying is that sometimes even when you know those people who need to be cut, even very quickly, there is an HR process that kind of forces you to keep these people on. So if it was that simple and you could cut people as soon as you know, and even they know and colleagues know that they're not the right person, it would make the workplace a much easier place and a much better place to enable people's success.
What's the early? Maybe you can't say how soon have you terminated someone's employment, or you know, when you realized it wasn't working.
A few months. And I think in that case, it took a very open conversation on both sides. And actually, the person realized through that conversation that they just weren't going to be successful. Mm. And in other cases, people just refused to let go, and it was really not possible.
Let's hear from Alison van Diggelen. Have you ever, I mean, it's a bit different in media, isn't it? It's more of a sort of free form business, isn't it? But have you seen people leave almost as soon as they've arrived?
My experience with hiring, last summer I hired some interns, or I put an ad on Craigslist for interns, and my experience was it was a painful experience just going through all these dozens of applicants, the cringeable grammar, the whole me mentality, why I'd like the job rather than, you know, how I can help Fresh Dialogues. It was a really interesting kind of slice through the younger generation. I did find a couple of fantastic interns in the end, but it was a real eye-opener to me that, you know, this me mentality of some millennials was kind of shocking.
Mm, very interesting. And they're obviously taking to Twitter as well, even if they don't like the job that they're about to start. Thank you so much, Alison van Diggelen, host of the radio program Fresh Dialogues in San Francisco. And also Tony Nash from Delta Economics, based in Singapore, our two guests today. Thank you for listening to Business Matters.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.